you've been feeling over the last week, couple of weeks. But I reckon there's a fair amount of fear going on, don't you? I've never lived through a war. I've never lived through a plague. In fact, I can't ever think of a time where our world seemed to be so drastically impacted, where our daily lives were so affected as they now are at the moment. It's still like unprecedented times, don't it? A lot of people, I think, are feeling afraid, and it's bringing the worst out in people. I mean, fancy two blokes punching up over toilet paper in a supermarket aisle. I mean, that's just crazy, isn't it? That feeling that things are out of control, that heightened anxiousness. And we've got to have people who are struggling to sleep at the moment. They're so worried about what will happen, what the future will hold. There's a palpable sense of fear across the community, and I don't ever remember anything like that before. I mean, that's the reason why people are panic buying, isn't it? My friend of mine, his name's Michael, he's a pastor of a church as well, and he went to his local Woolworths, and he was waiting for the lift, and the lift opened. There was a lady there with a trolley just full of toilet paper, and they just looked at each other, and she said, "I don't know what I'm doing." I think a lot of people feel that way right now. What will happen to what will happen tomorrow? What will happen to my job, my mortgage, my family, my health, those I love? People are staring at the unknown, afraid, not knowing where it will all end, facing loneliness, angry at anyone and everyone, and I'm sure you've experienced some of those feelings. A number of my friends have decided to stay off social media because they've realised that the relentless barrage of articles, news updates, posts about the virus, it just sort of weighs you down. And I felt that this week, I don't know about you. And as Christians, we're not immune to those feelings either, are we? And maybe you're feeling that way right now. In fact, maybe you're a little bit annoyed because you came here to escape virus talk and now here it is again. And I'm sorry if that's the case. But it's actually really appropriate that tonight we look at this part of the book of Daniel. We've been working through Daniel over the last couple of months, those of you who have been here and joined us. Because the book of Daniel too was written to a people who were perplexed, afraid, facing crisis, loss of jobs, homes, livelihoods, afraid of a future that seemed so uncertain, wondering whether God had lost control. And the same word that was for their comfort, God has preserved for us, and it too is for our comfort. And this is a word, friends, I think we need for just a time as this, the message of the book of Daniel. A lot of people, when they're reading through the book of Daniel, stop after chapter 6. You might have been part of churches where you do the first 6 chapters and then you just kind of stop. And I've been tempted to do that. I get it. Because the first 6 chapters of Daniel are these wonderful stories of the fiery furnace, the lion's den, the writing of the wall, they're nice contained narratives. And then something strange happens and it all just gets a bit odd. It gives way to something very different. Now, I have never in my life consumed or smoked a mind-altering substance. But if I did, I imagine that I would be confronted with something like what Daniel is confronted with here in these chapters. And very strange, I don't know if you felt that way while we were reading them. We move from narrative to what we call apocalyptic, a brand new genre, a word used of a specific genre that was common in the ancient world, but it's actually very strange for us, I think. The word apocalypse, it means to reveal something that's hidden. Perhaps something about the future or something about the world as it truly is. And that's what these chapters are. They're steeped in imagery and symbolism. And I hope that was kind of obvious as we read them, right? That they're full of imagery and symbolism. As some of you will know that I'm a bit of a fan of the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. I listen to his podcast and I like him. He'll often talk about having a cosmic perspective. That is, recognizing who we are in light of the planets and the age of stars and black holes and getting out of our small little worlds to see the big picture. Well, that's what this apocalyptic literature does. But it takes us even a step beyond what Neil deGrasse Tyson wants us to do. It gives us a glimpse of reality, not just from a cosmic perspective, but from the perspective of eternity. To lift us from our small little worlds and show us the world how God sees it. The real world, the forest beyond the trees. Now, I've got to be straight up with you. It's a little bit tricky. And I'm going to ask you to work a little bit today. It's probably not the passage I would have picked, but it's the passage God has picked for us in his sovereignty as we've worked through Daniel. He's decided that's for us to hear. And that makes it super important. If this is your very first time at church, this might be a little bit intense. So please hang in there, because I think it's worth it. Because it is this vision. It's this perspective that Daniel sees and tells us about that is designed to propel God's people towards a future with confidence, security, and hope. Friends, that's what we need now. Certainty in a time of crisis. And we're going to look at these two chapters together for some reasons that might become obvious, but really we'll be spending most of our time on the first one. I thought about kind of just skimming over a bunch of stuff. I thought, nah, you know what, let's just go for it. We might not be doing this again for a while, so why not? I will begin with a vision. Those of you who have been here, I've been working through Daniel, you'll be familiar with visions. They've come up quite a lot. Usually someone else has a vision, and then Daniel explains what it means. But in this chapter, it's Daniel who has the vision. In fact, have a look with me, verses 2. Chapter 7, verses 2 to 8. I'll read them out loud and you follow along. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I was watching, and suddenly the four winds of heaven stirred up the great sea. Four huge beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, but had eagle's wings. I continued watching until its wings were torn off. It was lifted up from the ground, set on its feet like a man, and given a human mind. Suddenly another beast appeared, a second one that looked like a bear. It was raised up on one side with three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up, gorge yourself on flesh.' After this, while I was watching, suddenly another beast appeared. It was like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. It had four heads and was given dominion. After this, while I was watching in the night vision, suddenly a fourth beast appeared, frightening and dreadful and incredibly strong with large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled with its feet whatever was left. It was different from the other beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was considering a horn, suddenly another horn, a little one, came up from among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. And suddenly, in this horn, there were eyes like the eyes of a human and a mouth that was speaking arrogantly." Now just stop there for a moment. I want you to notice a couple of things. First of all, this is crazy, right? Did you notice that? Daniel is taken down to the sea. Now, that is an ominous place for an Israelite, right? The sea represented chaos, danger, and death. They were not a seafaring people. They stayed well away from the sea. And then these four beasts arise out of the water, one after another, terrifying kind of hybrid animals with multiple heads and wings and horns. And then a fourth beast, who seems to kind of be made of metal, with, did you notice, a talking horn, who is boasting arrogantly. Then you kind of start to get the feel for what apocalyptic literature is. It's not meant to be taken literally. If you head down to the beach, if you head down to Secula Beach expecting to see a four-headed leopard arise from the water, you will be disappointed. That's not how this literature works. These are symbols. They represent things. And in fact, as we'll come to see in a moment what they are kingdoms. But I want you to notice they are deliberately frightening. They're meant to be scary. They're powerful and they're violent. They're like something out of a nightmare. In great contrast to what happens next. See, we move from this vision of fear and chaos to a courtroom and to the presence of God. Look at verses 9 to 12 with me. "And so I kept watching, thrones were set in place, And the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white like snow, and the hair of his head was white as wool. His throne was flaming fire, its wheels were blazing fire. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from his presence. Thousands upon thousands served him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was convened and the books were opened. I watched them because of the sound of the arrogant words the horn was speaking. As I continued watching, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to burning fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was removed. An extension of life was granted them for a certain period of time. I just stopped there for a moment. This is a picture of God, the Ancient of Days, who takes his seat, his judgment seat, who convenes a court, and judgment is passed. Judgment is passed on these four beasts. The books of deeds are opened, and their kingdoms are removed. Their power taken away, and they are destroyed. They face the terrible judgment of God. And then something really important happens. Verse 13 and 14, and look at it with me. I continued watching in the night visions, and suddenly one like a son of man was coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was escorted before him. He was given dominion and glory and a kingdom so that those of every people, nation and language should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. One of the books I was reading, so I was thinking about this passage. One scholar said, this is the most important passage in the Old Testament. And I don't know if I quite agree, but it's pretty important. But I want you to notice a few things. First of all, do you remember that previously the vision was of these kind of morphed, hideous, violent animals? Now we have a human being. That's important. He's called one like a son of man. Now, by itself, that expression just means a person. In fact, did you notice in chapter 8, verse 17, Gabriel calls Daniel, hey, you son of man. But did you notice what this son of man does? Did you pick it up? He comes into the presence of the Ancient of Days. And unlike those beasts who receive judgment and have their kingdoms taken away, he is given a kingdom. In fact, it's a universal kingdom that all peoples from every language and tribe will serve him. It's an eternal kingdom that never ends. See, this picture in Daniel 7 is of a coronation of a human being. This is an enthronement. This is a crowning. Now, if you're familiar with the New Testament, you may already know that Son of Man was one of Jesus' favorite titles to refer to himself. That's the title he used most of all. All the way through the gospel. And in case you're confused, you might know this passage at the end of Mark's gospel from Mark chapter 14. Again, the high priest questioned him, are you the Messiah, that means a king, the son of the blessed one? I am, said Jesus. And you will see the son of man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. So that's straight out of Daniel, isn't it? Straight out of Daniel. This is the one who has been given the kingdom by God. The Messiah, God's anointed king. Even the high priest knows that's who Daniel's talking about. And Jesus is saying, this is me. I'm that guy that Daniel saw in his vision. Now that's an extraordinary claim to make, isn't it? That's an extraordinary claim for Jesus. And I just want you to take a breath, because we're pushing hard. And you might be kind of confused, perhaps even a little scared. And if you are, you've got that in common with Daniel, because three times he has to lie down, he turns pale, he's perplexed, he's confused. And fair enough, I would be too had I seen these visions. Now, friends, you always got to be wary of people. Some Christians do this as well, who claim to know the purposes of God without any sort of special revelation. Or to put it another way, who claim to know what God is doing in the world without God actually explaining what he's doing in the world. Does that kind of make sense? And so I've heard bushfires, I've heard Christians over the last few months say things like this. The bushfires were God's judgment against same-sex marriage. Now, maybe they are, but you don't know. I've heard Christians say the COVID-19 virus is God's judgment against communism. Well, perhaps. But unless God actually tells you that this is his judgment against communism, you don't really know. Don't try and guess the mind of God. His plans are not our plans. His ways are not our ways. God does give us the big picture, but not every detail along the way, but sometimes he does. Daniel sees the vision of events unfolding in our world, and instead of running to wild speculations, like I want to suggest some readers of Daniel do, he goes and asks what they mean. Look at verse 15 and 16. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was deeply distressed within me, fair enough. And the visions in my mind terrified me. I approached one of those who was standing by and asked him to clarify all this, so he let me know the interpretation of these things. These huge beasts, four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth, but the holy ones of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess it forever, yes, forever and ever. The beasts are kingdoms. Now, we've already kind of seen this. We've seen our kingdoms represented in visions. Some of you were here when we looked at Daniel chapter 2, when Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of a giant statue with kind of four different sections, and each one of those sections related to a particular kingdom that was going to come. And most people, there's some sort of general consensus about which nation represents which kind of part of the body. There's a bit of dispute, but more or less they were divided into the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks and then the Romans. And now we have four beasts, and you understand why people kind of make a connection. Here again, this time representative beasts, we have these four different kingdoms which are mentioned. And look, a lot of the kind of details make sense. So the bear has three ribs in its mouth, and people think, well, that's probably the three kings that the Persians kind of conquered, the king of Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz. And, well, maybe. You see, it's kind of a bit of a guess. In fact, sometimes it's very hard to come up with an interpretation of history that fits very nicely with what we read in Daniel. In fact, there are some details that we're really not sure what they mean, particularly when it comes to this fourth beast. Did you notice that? Look at verses 19 through to 27 with me. Then I want to be clear about the fourth beast, the one different from all the others, extremely terrifying with iron teeth and bronze claws, devouring, crushing and trampling with its feet whatever was left. I also want to know about the ten horns on the head and about the other horn that came up before which the other three fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth and spoke arrogantly and looked bigger than the others. As I was watching, this horn waged war against the holy ones and was prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days arrived and the judgment was given in favour of the holy ones of the Most High, for the time had come and the holy ones took possession of the kingdom. This is what he said. The fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom of the earth, different from all the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth, trample it and crush it. The ten horns and ten kings will rise from this kingdom. Another king, different from the previous ones, will rise after them and subdue three kings. He will speak words against the Most High and oppress the holy ones of the Most High. He will intend to change religious festivals and laws, and the holy ones will be handed over to him for a time, times and half a time. But the court will convene, and his dominion will be taken away to be destroyed completely forever. The kingdom's dominion and greatness of the kingdoms under all of heaven will be given to the people, holy ones of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting dominion, and all rulers will serve and obey him. There's a bit there, isn't there? Who are these ten rulers, these ten kings? That would be really nice. Is this talking about the kingdom of Rome? Well, Rome had something like 60 different kings, but they certainly did oppose God. Perhaps this number 10 is a figurative number. It represents the whole. Some people think that too. Or perhaps it's a kingdom still to come. Maybe it's the European Union. A lot of people think it could be. And then who is this little arrogant horn that springs up? Horns are represented power, rulers in the ancient world. A horn that springs up and opposes God and oppresses his people and even shuts down the worship of the temple. Who is this little horn? Well, how long you got? Because the theories are many. Is it Alexander the Great? Well, some people think it is. Is it the Seleucid king Antiochus IV, who in the 2nd century persecuted the Jews and turned the temple into a pagan house of worship? Well, some people think that it is. Is this Donald Trump? Well, a lot of people think it is. Or, if your political persuasion is somewhere else, is it Obama? Or is it Billy Graham? I can't figure that out, but that is a view that is out there. Or is it the Pope, which is another view? Or is it someone still to come? The Antichrist. Is it you? And you get why people find this very exciting, right? There are lots and lots of books written about this and lots of theories. Though if it is still, if someone's still to come, I hazard it's going to be hard to disrupt the temple sacrifices at this point when the temple has actually been destroyed. We get a fuller description of this little horn in chapter 8, if you believe it's the same. I take it that it is because the descriptions are so similar, but some people think it's not. No one really kind of feeds neatly into this description, which is why a lot of people think, well, it's someone still to come. In fact, if you go home and Google who is the little horn of Daniel 7 and 8, you will all of a sudden find yourself lost in a spiral of end time prophecy that seems to never end. Here's my question for you. Why the apocalyptic language? Right, why not just tell us? Why doesn't it just say the kingdom's called Greece and there's this guy called Alexander the Great and he's going to rise and then he'll do this and that and then he'll die and then something else will happen? Why not just kind of straight out lay it out for us? Well, could it be that this imagery, which lends itself to so many various interpretations, might be deliberately designed to be applicable across a range of historical contexts, so that God's people of every age can locate themselves and their circumstances in this story? You understand? Let me explain again. Does not the huge range of interpretations, which feel a little bit to me like guesses, indicate that it's not super obvious who the ten kings are and who the little horn is, and that's on purpose? So that readers across the centuries can read their own experiences of injustice and persecution into the text. I think so. In fact, I think that's how apocalyptic language works. Now, that's a bit controversial, what I've just said. And you might have a different view about this, and that's okay too. You might be thoroughly convinced that this is about Donald Trump. And maybe it is, and I've got it wrong. It would be quite interesting, actually, to track all the details about all the theories and all the different things that happen in this passage. Well, it'd be interesting for a couple of people. And we just don't have time to do that now, obviously. And a little part of me is glad that we don't. Because the mistake I think people make when they read Daniel is in an effort to make all the details fit, they miss the forest for the trees. But the key thing in this passage is not whether the little horn is Alexander the Great or the Pope, but that whatever kingdom arises and whatever king rules and whatever they do to God's people, they will in the end be conquered by God and subdued by his king. Right, that is the cosmic perspective. That is the big picture. It doesn't matter who the little horn is. What matters is that Jesus will conquer him or her or them. That the evil of this world and all that is opposed to God and his people might prevail for a time, but will in the end all be overcome. Their kingdoms, as frightening as they are, will be taken away and given. Did you notice who to? To the people of God. Two of those verses that we read, I'll just put them up on the screen together. I'll read them out. Until the Ancient of Days arrived and a judgment was given in favour of the Holy Ones and the Most High. For the time had come and the Holy Ones took possession of the kingdom. The kingdom, dominion and greatness of the kingdoms under all of heaven will be given to the people. the holy ones of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will serve and obey him. Friends, this is the big takeaway. And what an important message it was to hear for the people of Israel living in exile, suffering under unjust rulers. Though it may have looked like they had been defeated, God is in fact still reigning. God will reign and their kingdoms will be destroyed. And all of those great beasts, we can look back in our history and see that none of them lasted. God's king will overcome them all. His holy people will inherit the kingdoms. So this is a message of hope, isn't it? The whole book of Daniel is a message of hope. It's not meant to make people afraid. It's meant to give them confidence to endure. That in the hard times they might have a cosmic perspective, to have the veil lifted and see the world as it truly is, how God sees it. Isn't this a message for us too, right? We're a people who are afraid, perhaps not of a kingdom arising somewhere that might conquer us, but fearful nonetheless of the future. I mean, the world is a scary place. It feels out of control. And these chapters are particularly relevant to those people who are suffering persecution, especially state-sanctioned persecution, like many Christians around the world are right now. But I think this is also a vision for us, to give us hope and endurance to see things the way that God sees them. See, for Daniel's contemporaries, he promised an event that would happen in their future when he would set his king over every kingdom. Though for us, it's a little bit different. And we're not going to spend much time on chapter 8, partly because it's just really similar. I don't know if you noticed that. We've got this time two beastly creatures causing havoc on the earth, one a goat, one a ram. We're told that they're the kingdoms of the Medes and Persians and the kingdom of Greece. We both see them rise and fall. I think there probably is a reference to Alexander the Great there in verse 21. Again, a little horn arises and speaks arrogantly. He opposes God's people, he opposes God himself, and he undermines true worship. And he seems to win for a time. But, here's the important thing again, he is overcome and defeated, and God reigns. Same messages. When does all this happen? Well, you might have noticed we have a couple of references there to the end. Just look at chapter 8, verse 19. Or just before that, then he touched me and said, stand up, and said, I am here to tell you what will happen at the conclusion of the time of wrath, because it refers to the appointed time of the end. There's a few references there. Now you might be thinking, well, hang on, Persia and Greece, that was like forever ago. Is this talking about the end of the world? And yes, it is. Kind of. Now I want you to stay with me. You might have heard of a famous scientist called Einstein. He discovered at some point in the 20th century that time was indeed relative. I don't know if you knew that. So previously everyone thought that time was a fixed thing, and he kind of discovered and proved that no, time is different for you and me and everything. And if that doesn't make sense, go and watch the movie Interstellar. That's kind of what's going on. That still won't make sense, but that's kind of what I'm talking about. Well, Einstein could have just read the book of Daniel and he would have discovered that time is relative. So when the Old Testament speaks of the end of the world, it speaks of something called the day of the Lord. The day when God is going to show up, redeem his people, overcome all injustice, and bring about his righteous judgment, and deliver the eternal reign of the Messiah in his perfect kingdom that will last forever. And some of you would know that when Jesus arrives on the scene, you remember what he said? The kingdom of God has come upon you. It's broken in. It's here. But what we discover in the New Testament is that this day of the Lord, this end, has now been stretched. It's been stretched out first for 1,000 years and now for 1,000 more. And that's why we experience this strange tension in the world, don't we? We see that Jesus has actually overcome sin completely. And yet we still experience its effects. We see that Jesus has defeated death. And yet we still die. We see that Jesus sits on the throne, all authority. But some knees have not yet bowed. We see that Jesus has completely sanctified us, made us holy, washed us. But we still struggle with our sin. The job's finished. Jesus has nothing left to do. He takes his seat at the right hand of the Father. That's a job's done seat. The promises have all been fulfilled. They've come true. Every promise is true in Jesus. I heard a preacher try to describe this once. You have to roll with me here. As if Jesus was playing a soccer match and the score was 100-0 to Jesus and we're in stoppage time. Like Jesus pretty much won. I didn't like that. Here's why. You can still score 100 goals, in theory. It's far more like the final whistle's blown, Jesus has won, and now we're just getting the trophy out. That's the age that we live in. Or perhaps a lot more eloquently, the German Jürgen Moltmann. This is one of my favourite quotes. Listen to this, what he said about it. The believer is not set at the high noon of life, but at the dawn of a new day, at the point where night and day, things passing and things to come, grapple with each other. I think that's true. We don't exist in the middle of human history. We've come to the end. This day of the Lord has been stretched. It's been extended, and it's because it's been extended, 1 Peter tells us, because of the mercy of God, that more and more people might escape the kingdoms of this world and might come and belong to the kingdom of God, the eternal kingdom that all are now invited into. See, friends, we're not waiting for Jesus to become king. He already reigns. And all people must submit to him. Friends, we live at the end. Jesus has already done everything. All we're waiting for now is what he's already done to be fully realized by all creation. What's the cosmic perspective at a time like this? Well, it's the King of all kings enthroned forever. It's one like a son of man, overcoming all of his enemies, defeating them and their power. It is the God of all righteousness, steering our world towards a glorious future and a glorious inheritance for his people. And if you could but for a moment glimpse the world as it truly is, that is what you would see. You'd see Jesus on the throne, in charge, in control of everything. You know, in the second and third centuries, a number of plagues battered Europe. There was the Antoine plague of the second century, the Cyprian plague of the third. Massive, massive casualties. Far more than we're going to have with our virus. Did you know it was the Christians who cared for the people? Many of them got sick and died. And yet the gospel spread like a wildfire. And tell me, what would cause someone to give their life to care for someone else? Well, you'd have to have a perspective of eternity, wouldn't you? An unshakable confidence that the best was still to come. Hope in a glorious future and a God who has secured. Brothers and sisters, plagues are our time to shine. I don't know what tomorrow will bring, or the next day, or the day after that. But the day after that, I can tell you with certainty. It's God's people reigning with their King in an eternal kingdom. Jesus promised the thief on the cross who recognized Jesus as the King, that he would be for on that day with him in paradise. I don't know what was going through Jesus' mind when he said that word paradise, but I reckon he didn't know. God's people reigning with their King in an eternal kingdom. Friends, if you grasp that, if you see that, then the world doesn't seem quite so frightening. The heart doesn't seem quite so anxious, and the future doesn't seem quite so out of control, because it's not. Father, we pray for our nation. Heal it. Pray for each other. Protect us. We pray for our broader community. Comfort our anxious hearts. Give us your vision of reality, the risen and reigning Jesus Christ. And may that be our God, our light, and our hope. In Jesus' name.